All right, welcome everybody. It's good to see you. We will get started here in just a minute. Missy is still heavily in conversation, so I'll wait for that to end. Okay, now we're good. All right, so we're going to continue our study tonight. We'll probably go through at least one more class period in studying Peter. I think you know why it is useful to sit down and study. There's just a lot of really good stories and information that we learn about Peter, and we'll review a little bit of what we talked about last time and talk about a few more things as we just kind of go through. As I said, he's kind of bookended a little bit in that he had some things that were really encouraging. He had some things that he was rebuked for. There were things that he did that were the shame of his life. But then he did some things that just meant a lot to the mission of the kingdom. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit more tonight. So let's bow and pray, and then we'll begin. Our Father in heaven, we're thankful for every blessing you give us. We're thankful first and foremost for your Son, Jesus Christ. We're thankful for his sacrifice. We're thankful that even though we are sinners, you forgive us, and you give us mercy and grace through him. We ask your forgiveness of our sins, and we ask that you would help us to live lives of obedience and service. We ask that as we're here together, that you would help us to encourage each other, that you would help us to bear each other's burdens, and that you would help us to exemplify you in everything we do. We pray all these things in Christ's name, and amen. All right, so we're going to look a little bit further about Peter tonight. As you remember, Peter was a fisherman, a simple person who was called during his fishing duties to go and follow Christ. We have evidence that he may have been one of the older apostles. He may have been close to 30 or around 30 years old, which shows that even Clay Morris could have been an apostle at his old age. And Taylor Leggett, by the way, when I said Taylor Leggett was in his 20s, I won't say who told me, but somebody carrying a baby came and wanted to correct me in no uncertain terms that he is most certainly not less than 30 years old. So I got that corrected. But he was still a young man, and we see, he does things that are somewhat impetuous, and these stories we get from him are just such good insight into what it was like to be a follower of Christ, an immediate follower of Christ. And so we looked at his calling, and then we looked at this story in Matthew 16 where Jesus was asking them about who the people say he is. And when he asked the apostles, Peter gave his answer, one of the most important phrases that we have written in the Bible, to say that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And let's remember what was said. Jesus then said, where did he get that information? Was it from this empirical evidence that he had seen it and recognized it? Where did he get it? The Father in heaven revealed it to him. Flesh and blood didn't reveal it. God did. And so he has this information that is so important to what Jesus is trying to accomplish. And then he goes on, and Jesus says some things that are very important, though they have been used in so many different ways incorrectly. What he says is very simple. He tells him that he's going to build his church on this truth that God has revealed, on this basic truth, that his church will be based on that, and that it is so strong that all of the schemes of the devil are not able to beat that. He said that Peter would be given the keys of the kingdom, and then there's this indication that it is really these disciples that will be given the keys to the kingdom. And we know, and if we talk about Peter in particular, we know that later on he's going to be involved in one extremely important part of the mission of Christ. And how would we consider that opening doors? What did Peter lead the charge on that was so important to the ministry of Christ? Yeah, to bringing it to the Gentiles. And so that the concept of this keys to the kingdom kind of might play a little, but him preaching that. But then all of these disciples now going and establishing the model for what a Christian is to be, what the church is to be. And we see how important that is. And how important it is, we talked last time, you might have remembered Mr. Meyer's dastardly questions that he was asking. And the important part is that this was something that was told to these disciples, and they had special gifts to do that. And we don't have the ability to establish that model anymore. And him telling them this was very special. And he took this opportunity to establish that. Now, soon after that, he starts talking to his disciples about the fact that it says that it would be necessary for him to go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and to be killed and raised up on the third day. Peter's reaction to that was to do what? He took him aside. It says he took him aside and he says, God forbid it. And I just think that he pulls him aside. We're going to study another story here in a minute where he does almost the exact same thing. But he takes him aside and says, absolutely not. What you just said, I will never let it happen. And Jesus' reaction was to say what? Get behind me, Satan. And I thought it was a good point that was made last night, or last time we met, that what Jesus was saying was, you stop saying things like that. You're saying, God forbid it, that it will never happen. Jesus knows that this was the ultimate goal of Satan, was to thwart God's purpose. And he says, stop it. Don't say things like that. You're not getting the point. The point here is God's plan. Man's plan would be very different. And so he tells him that you need to focus on what God's purpose is, not just what our personal needs are. Let's turn now over to Matthew 14. And I want to look at a few different, we're going to go to Matthew 14, then we're going to jump to Matthew 26, a little bit in John 13, because I will say that the stories of Peter are broken up a little bit. And so I'm trying my best to get, there are details about these stories that are put in different areas. And so we do want to make sure we try to find all these little tidbits that we get related to Peter. So in Matthew 14, it says in verse 22, immediately afterward, he compelled the disciples to get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. After he had sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already a long distance from the land, battered by the waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But the disciples saw him walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, it's a ghost. And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, take courage, it is I, do not be afraid. So we see this story about where Peter appears to them walking on the water. Their immediate reaction is, it's a ghost. And I don't know exactly why that was their reaction. Obviously, it was such a strange sight to see a person walking on the water that, and this isn't the only time, by the way, that people guess that something weird happens and they guess it's a ghost. And so I can't give you any great insight except that we might say the same thing, that if something crazy happens. But that's what they say when they see him. And it says they cried out in fear. Jesus calmed them down. He says, it's I, don't be afraid. Then let's look in verse 28. Peter responded and said to him, Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water. And he said, come. And Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came toward Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became frightened. And when he began to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus reached out with his hand and took hold of him and said to him, you of little faith, why did you doubt? When they got into the boat, the wind stopped. And those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, you are truly God's son. So maybe one of the more famous stories about Peter, even in secular circles, people know the story of walking on the water, and people will talk about that, and even the concept of how Peter did. But isn't it interesting that they see it on the water, they see someone walking, their reaction is, it's a ghost, they're scared to death of the ghost. But when Jesus speaks to them and calms them down, Peter's immediate response is to say, if it's you, command me to come out on the water. What are the reasons that this would be Peter's response to seeing this? Why is it? I mean, I think we almost take it for granted that his response to seeing Jesus walk on the water was to say, if it's you, then tell me to walk on the water as well. Do you have any thoughts about why that would be his response? There could be multiples. One might be, He thought it was neat and wanted to try it. And I think that we have enough insight into Peter to think that might be the reason. It might just be that he thought, I'm going to jump into the walking on the water thing you're doing here. So maybe he just thought, not really something you record in the Bible. Any other thing you can think of why he would do this? Yeah. I have to say that you see evidence throughout Peter's life and others that they were trying things out. Peter definitely was one who would say things and would just, he was wanting to see, was this it? Or trying, and so it may be that he saw this and he thought, I need to take part in this. Or this is something that I should be doing. And he wanted to see. Any other reasons you can think of why he does this? Isn't it interesting how he starts off where he says, Lord, if it is you, command me to come out on the water. And so that it makes me think that it wasn't on purpose that was recorded, that he said, if it's you. The part of this may have been confusion and wanting to prove this, but I think we have to recognize how hard it is to take a step onto open water, and that he had to take that step and start walking on water. And there was something about this scenario where he's still trying to figure out Jesus and how he's working and what he's doing and what powers Jesus is exhibiting. And I feel like this was just part of this ongoing engagement he has with Jesus about building this trust and understanding what he's dealing with here. But so let's look at that, because I think that's an interesting perspective to say. It says, but seeing the wind, he became frightened, and when he began to sink, he cried out saying, Lord, save me. That not only did he step out, and clearly he was given that ability, and it says, he walked on the water and came toward Jesus. But then what caused him to stop? What's that? He questioned it. What did you say? Yeah, he questioned the situation. It was almost like he said, what in the world am I doing here? Yeah. Yeah, I think we have to recognize, when we're going to keep studying this, this lack of perfect clarity that they've got about exactly how this all works. Because Jesus still does things that amazes them. And Jesus does other things that terrify them. And they ask questions all the time and they re-ask questions. And so I think we have to recognize that this was new. And and Jesus hasn't been just teaching them every intricate detail of how everything's going to work. In some cases, he tells them just a little bit and then tells them not to tell anybody about it. So the fact that this is a confusing situation, especially for Peter, is not strange. But it says that he saw the wind and became frightened, and that's when he began to sink. And I think what you said kind of helps get some insight into this, that he had this faith, he was feeling good about it, but it was then he saw, it said weather was contrary. He sees how dangerous this situation is and starts to question whether this really is possible. This reminds me of the parable of the sower and of the seeds. It always reminds me of that, to see somebody who starts off with this exciting faith, and Peter is great at starting things, and has this exciting faith, and then whenever things got fearful or difficult or strange, he took his eye off of it and lost his nerve. Just like we learn about, the rocky ground where there's just no root, or the idea of the thorns. You remember what it says about whenever there's a seed and the thorns choke it out? What are those? What is the interpretation that Jesus gives us of those thorns? Do you remember? What's that? Cares of the world. When they talk about the thorns, when a person's, I want to call it weeds, when their roots are going down, the thorns choke that out. And there's this idea that you're doing fine, but as soon as worries happen, it starts to tear down that strength of faith. Is there anybody in here who feels like they are drugged down frequently about worry? I would be willing to guess that there's a number of people in this room who almost worry all the time. Is anybody in here like that, where they worry just about everything? There are other people in here who are eternal optimists who pretend like nothing bad will ever happen. There's some of you in here too. But it is interesting to me how prevalent in the conservative church an attitude of constant fretting and worry is. What is one of the most common, the most frequently made statements of the New Testament? It happens 365 times, actually, in the Bible. What is one of the most common phrases in the Bible? Do not fear. Do not worry. Fear not. Do not be anxious. Do not be concerned. And I think it was on purpose that it's such a common phrase. From Jesus' mouth, from the apostles in the writings, fear not. Do not fear. Yet, in this case, we see fear is what tore down his faith at this moment. We see the example of the cares of the world, things that are causing us to worry, tearing down. And I have to admit, I'm a person who's not a constant worrier, but when I do worry, it wears me out. I don't sleep. I'm a person who, if I have something that's worrying me, I'm the one who wakes up at 4:25 in the morning, and then it's done. There ain't any more sleeping happening. Am I the only one who, for some reason, if you wake up in the wee hours of the night, everything in your life seems 10 times worse than it really is, and then as soon as you walk out the front door that morning, it seems like it's not so bad? It's just all part of this kind of human condition, I think, that we are in our own head. But in this case, it's so interesting to me to see that Peter had Jesus himself successfully cause him to walk on water, and within moments sank because his faith became weak, and called out to Jesus and said, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and took hold of him. And what was his response? Whenever Jesus talked to him and helped him up, he said, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" It's another moment where Peter really he stepped out and did something amazing and then faded and had to have Jesus rebuke him and have Jesus say to him directly, you who were defined by little faith. He had just defined him as a rock, and based on what he said, he would establish a kingdom. And he says, "You of little faith." And that makes me think that that's the kind of thing that we have to apply to ourselves. Is there anything wrong with doubting, with having doubts? I think there's one of those things that we find out that when we read Scripture, that some people learn from it that weaknesses and doubts are sin. And I think that sometimes that causes people to be defeatist about their capacity to be saved. But I feel like this story isn't designed to tell us that we should never have a moment like this, that we should never have a moment of weakness, we should never have a moment where our faith struggles. The question is, when we do, what happens then? What happens next? Peter did what? Peter had a moment of weakness. He was afraid and he went to sink. And what was his reaction? He said, "Lord, save me." He reached out and said, "Lord, save me." But Jesus said, "Why did you doubt?" And I think we can't spend a lot of time on this, but I think we should think about this idea about What are the ebbs and flows of our life when it comes to strength of faith and weakness of faith? I feel like there may be a perception out there that our responsibility is to never experience weakness, and that if we do, we are somehow a diminished Christian. But when you read the epistles, when you read what these apostles were establishing, there is clearly a model that says, you are humans, you are weak, you make mistakes, you have times where burdens weigh you down. God thought of that already, and God created a mechanism for you to be able to obtain encouragement. And so I feel like when we see Peter in this circumstance, I hope we understand that we need to work hard to maintain a strong faith, even against worries, but that it's normal, and it's something that happens, and our responsibility is then to take a moment of weakness and reach out to the right things and make an attempt, you know, use the tools that we've been given in order to try to get out of that. And so the story of Peter here to me is interesting, just in that we see another moment of weakness and another recovery. Now, whenever he got back in the boat, it says he got back in the boat and the wind stopped, and those who were on the boat worshiped him, saying, "You are truly God's son." So this moment of him walking on the water clearly attempted the purpose of encouraging the people on this boat and causing them to have the proper reaction. Let's turn over now to Matthew 26, and we'll look at another story of Peter. This first one, I'm going to break it into a couple parts. We're going to read Matthew 26, and we're also going to go over to John 13. And so they're here at eating the Passover feast, and in verse 26, Matthew 26, 26, "Now while they were eating, Jesus took some bread, and after a blessing, he broke it and gave it to the disciples, saying, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' And when he had taken a cup and given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is being poured out for many for forgiveness of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it with you new in my Father's kingdom.' After singing a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives." And so this is the scenario. He is hours from being arrested and going through his trials. And he is here establishing this supper with them. He tells them that it is his body and it is his blood. And he says, and he almost brings it now to this deadline, because he's been talking about how it's going to be necessary for him to go to Jerusalem and this in the future, what's going to happen. But in this scenario, he says, this is it. This moment we're sharing right now is the last time we're going to be doing this Passover together until we have the eternal Passover. And so he telegraphs to them that this is kind of a final moment. At some point during this, and we'll come back here in just a moment, but let's go to John 13. At some time during this, we see what happened in John 13. And we'll look in verse 3. "Jesus, knowing that the Father had handed all things over to him and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper and laid his outer garments aside. And he took a towel and tied it around himself. Then he poured water into the basin and began washing the disciples' feet and wiping them with a towel which he had tied around himself. So he came to Simon Peter and he said to him, 'Lord, you are washing my feet?' Jesus answered and said to him, 'What I'm doing you do not realize right now, but you will understand later.'" Let's stop there for a moment. So you see this scenario pointed out now where the disciples are around and Jesus gets up and wraps a towel around himself and gets down and with water and starts washing their feet. Let me ask you this first question. Was having their feet washed a weird thing? No. Having their feet washed was a perfectly normal thing. It happened all the time. It was a normal custom for after walking in sandals, you go to someone's house and there would be someone to wash feet. And so the foot washing part was not strange. Who had responsibility for washing feet in these scenarios? The servant, the lowest one, would have been the one. So the foot washing would have been normal, but done by the lowest servant. And they would have gotten up, and wrapped a towel around them and girded up, like it says, and they would have gotten the basin and done it this exact same way. And when Peter responds, we should definitely see this not as, what are you doing washing this? Why are you washing feet? What is the emphasis of what he says? Is it about washing feet? What's the emphasis of what Peter says back to him? Yeah. You are washing feet. Lord, you are washing feet? Wait a second. And I'm not sure that any of us would have had a different reaction. The person we were following, our rabbi, our master, the person that we're learning from, gets up and starts doing the lowliest task. I think maybe we would have said the same thing. Whoa, 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 whoa. I'll take care of that. I mean, we didn't see Peter say that, but we might say, can we find somebody else to do this? And he says, he responds to him like that. Why would that bother Peter? Why would it bother Peter that Jesus was washing his feet? Maybe the answer, some of the answer is obvious, but. So it bothers him because the master is doing servant's duty. And so that bothered him. Go ahead, Jim. Yes. And so it was who they worshiped, truly the Son of God, and he's now doing this menial task. I think another part of this is, where does that put Peter? Yes, he was looking at it about this hierarchy, that this human hierarchy that takes place about who does these tasks. And if the master is washing feet, where does that put Peter? Lower than that. And so he says in verse 8, Peter said to him, never will you wash my feet. Jesus answered, if I do not wash you, you have no place with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, he who has bathed needs only to wash his feet. Otherwise, he is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew the one who was betraying him. And it was for this reason that he had said, not all of you are clean. So this scenario, and this is one of those ones, I don't know if you ever have this thought, but I just think, just bless Peter's heart. He's just trying so hard. And am I the only one who sees that? It's just like, because he sees this and has this response that I can sympathize with. You know, wait, Lord, you know, are you doing this? And then he says, you will never wash my feet. And Jesus says, well, if I don't wash your feet, then you have no part of me. And what does Peter say? Well, yeah, okay, well, that's do feet then. And I have done that. I hope I'm not the only one who sometimes comes in a little too hot on something and then has to ratchet it back. Or I'm feeling a situation out, you know, like say you're dating a girl and you keep wanting to impress her with the things you like, and you're feeling out which ones she likes too. And so you're like, yeah, no, I love Broadway musicals. And she says, they're dumb. And you're like, no, they're stupid. I'm joking. No, that's dumb. That's the story of my life, by the way, is because all the things I like are the most ridiculous, pitiful things that you could like. And so I'm like, you know, I'm kind of into marching band. And then find out the girl doesn't like it. And you're like, yeah, marching band's for nerds. That's for the nerds. But I see this scenario with Peter. He's just coming out. He's coming in hot on all these things. Lord, never will you wash my feet. And Jesus says, well, if I don't wash your feet, then you can't be with me. Okay, then let's wash everything. Let's just keep washing. I'll take all of it. And even that is corrected. And certainly Jesus was not, you know, being punitive here in any way. But it is interesting that Jesus was getting this just right, where he says, well, then wash all of me. And Jesus says, well, those who are clean, only need their feet washed. And he says, and then makes a point, maybe a subtle point here, about saying, not all of you are clean. Giving him some insight into that he knows what's going to happen from here. We should go on and read that Jesus makes his point in verse 12. When he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, do you know what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are correct, for so I am. So if I, the Lord and the teacher washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example so that you would do just as I did for you. And we don't have time to go to it tonight, but I hope you'll read on your own time Philippians 2. Because it is the companion passage to this when Jesus says, Do you know what I just did? What I've done for you? I hope you understand that I washed your feet, but this is not the point. Your clean feet are not the point. He says, you call me Lord and Master, and you're right. I am the Lord. He doesn't diminish that. You are right. If I washed your feet, then you ought to wash one another's feet. Obviously. And I think that's what the point that comes out of this is, obviously, if the Master is washing feet, you ought to wash others' feet. And in Philippians 2, when we see Jesus, you know, have this attitude in yourselves that was also in Christ Jesus, that being in the form of God, didn't, you know, he was not grasping to the form of God. Instead, he humbled himself. And it says that he humbled himself to be a man, but not just a man. What kind? A servant. And he wasn't just a servant. What else happened? He was killed. And so this Philippians 2 to me is such an important companion to this, to say the Master came down to be a man, and not an important man, a servant. And that servant died. And he says, that's what you do. And he says that exact thing. This idea of dying for someone is the greatest service, the greatest sacrifice that can be made. And so we see Peter's reaction here, and it's almost like Peter was put there to help Jesus make his point. He was really good at walking it through. But his reaction, I think, was similar to what any of our reactions would be. Now I want to look at a couple passages if you turn to John 20 and John 21. And I'd like to just look at this while we have a little bit of time left. And then we're going to next time look at Jesus and his arrest and Peter's reaction and then the sermon at Pentecost. Let me see if I want to do this yet. Let's come back to that. Let's go. I'm missing a page here. Oh, here it is. Okay. Let's keep going. I should have kept going here in back to Matthew 26. I apologize. John 20 and 21 will come after this. We never finished Matthew 26. So we've gone over to John 13. We saw what else happened here at this supper. But now we'll look at Matthew 26, and we're going to start in verse 31. It says, then Jesus said to them, by the way, this was right after it says, and after singing a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, you will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I've been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. But Peter replied to him, even if they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Jesus said to him, truly I say to you that this very night before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And the disciples said the same thing as well. So everyone here knows the sad foreshadowing of this interaction, but I think we need to look at his response to Jesus, because this is once again where he steps in to say, absolutely not. Jesus says to them, you will all fall away because of me this night. I think Jesus here was not necessarily trying to establish a prophecy. I think he was trying to say, this is just a reality about what's going to happen. I think he was trying to indicate to them, you just don't have any idea about what's about to happen here. Every one of you will fall away because of it. And they have no concept, clearly. And he's telling them the story that says, listen, you don't know what's going to happen. All of you are going to go through some hard stuff. But after I've been raised from the dead, I'll meet you in Galilee. And once again, Peter was having none of it. And it says, even if they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. How might we put that in our own words? I am the last person that's going to fall away from you. There is no way. And Peter has no concept. He's like, I can't even imagine falling away from you. And Jesus said to him, listen, this tonight, before morning, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter responds, just as energetically, even if I have to die with you, I will never deny you. I will not do it. And it says, the other disciples, clearly Peter had an influence because the other disciples were all, yes, we all agree. We will all die before we deny you. I'll make a side point here just to say, I feel like there's a whole lot of Christians who feel that way about themselves, who feel like there is nothing that could ever make me turn from God. There is nothing that would ever cause me to question my faith or question what I know is truth. There's nothing, it's impossible. It was impossible for me to ever be told something or experience something that would cause me to go away from God. What Bible verse does that remind you of? Yeah. Yeah, and the idea that says, you know, let him that stands take heed lest he fall. Were you going to say something else, Mr. Adams?
Their response after falling is, I don't believe I did.
Yes, yeah, and then not understanding what caused it. But yeah, the idea that we would say it's impossible. And I will say that I've seen lots of people that fall into this category, that their inability to recognize that faith can be weak causes them to be a real danger of falling away. I have seen people who, at their highest level of what they consider to be biblical enlightenment, be at the point where they are in the most danger of falling away. And this statement to me, it has to be something we think about. Recognize, and Jesus said it, Jesus did not skirt the issue. Recognize the frailty of being a human, recognizing the things that you might never imagine would cause pressure on you, recognize the things that caused extremely strong people to lose their faith. And by doing that, I think we make ourselves stronger. And I think Peter here had to be taught that, had to be taught, don't pretend like you're not susceptible to making mistakes. Verse 69 is where it proves out. Now, Peter was sitting outside the courtyard, and a slave woman came to him and said, you too were with Jesus the Galilean. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you're talking about. When he had gone out to the gateway, another slave woman said to him, said to those who were there, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he denied it with an oath. I do not know the man. A little later, bystanders came up and said to Peter, you really are one of them as well, since even the way you talk gives you away. Then he began to curse and swear, I do not know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the statement that Jesus has made, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times, and went out and wept bitterly. We'll start here and we'll talk a little bit more about this on Sunday. This is such an important, I think, moment in Peter's life. But isn't it interesting that this was hours before that he had said so emphatically, I will die before I leave you. Even if everyone else falls away, I will not leave you. And then some really influential, mean, nasty people came up and put him on the spot, right? Like he had to really answer for himself in front of the entire Sanhedrin. Now, what was it that caused him the first denial? Yeah, a slave girl. And you know, it was just a girl came up and said, hey, weren't you with Jesus the Galilean? Nope, not, you are totally wrong. And so this is what it took for him to deny. Jay, were you going to say something?
Yes, coming back up a little bit. Peter's good intentions, his well intentions that he made that statement, he started off with those intentions.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I want to talk about that next time. There are people, and I'm one of them, who sometimes talk a big game. But when the chips are down, that's probably not an appropriate way of putting that. But whenever things get hard, or when things get really scary, it changes something. And all of a sudden, the decision-making process changes. So I want to start there next time. I want to look here again at what we learn about Peter, what he said and what he did, and how it is that we encounter things like this, and how we deal with that. So thank you very much for your input tonight. We'll continue here in Matthew 26 on Sunday.